this retreat ground, you wouldn't say the guy that spoke to us was just about bald-headed. But it was when I had a grateful spirit toward the way God made me and thanked him from a bald head and said, Lord, you know, hair's not better than bald. Praise you, I'm me, I'm good. God doesn't make junk. That the Lord did something about my hair even. Not because it was important or necessary, but because I guess he has a sense of humor. Or maybe he just wanted to bless me kind of special. But I know of some exciting things that God has done when people began to quit being bitter against him and be grateful for whatever he did on the outside and started cooperating with him to create or to build the qualities of Christ on the inside. But we exhorters do have difficulty with self-acceptance, more than some of the rest of you, though all of us may have had problems with that, and we need to ask God to forgive us and thank him for the way he made us. All right, what about givers? Givers have an ability to make wise purchases. The music of an exhorter is marching hymns. A mighty fortress is our God. Bulwark never failing and all that kind of stuff. All right, now givers know how to make money. They have a desire to give quietly. They attempt to use their giving to motivate others to give. I'll give the last $2,000. Y'all give the rest of it, and I'll finish up. They're alert to valid means that other people don't even see. They enjoy meeting the needs without pressure of appeals. You know, if someone gets up and say, boy, and really twists everybody and says, you know, twists everyone's arm and say, let's really give to this project, you know who gives least? Givers, because they don't like pressure to give. And then they have a joy when their gift was a special answer to prayer. And then they depend on their partner's counsel. The man will say, honey, what do you think I ought to give to this if he's a giver? And he'll say, just write it on a piece of paper and I'll write what I think we ought to give. And many times, I know a man and his wife both that are givers, and he said many times, it's just amazing how the figure is exactly the same. But they are very faithful to check with their partner about how much they ought to give to different projects. And then they're concerned that their gift must be the highest quality. I know one man who spent more money to have some clothes cleaned and so that they would be the nicest, chipper, starched clothes possible going out from that church than the clothes were worth. But he just didn't want the reputation of the Lord to, you know, be considered cheap or something. And then a desire to feel a part of the work of the person to whom they give. Sometimes that's misunderstood because when they give to something and then they'll really get in there with that person, well, sometimes the person will say, look, you gave your money, but that doesn't give you the right to tell us how to run this ministry. And then they avoid publicity because when other people hear, well, he gave $10,000, here they come, they want their $10,000, and so they avoid anybody knowing what they gave. Here are the misunderstandings. They deal with large sums of money, so some people in the church misunderstand that. Say, well, here comes old money bags. If he really loved the Lord, you know, he'd give all that away or something. A desire to increase his effectiveness of the ministry makes people that he gives to think that he's trying to control them, as I said. And then his attempt to encourage others to give makes his generosity seem to put more pressure on others than they should receive. So here's a guy that he's just barely made his budget. He's not sure how he's going to pay his phone bill. And then the giver stands up and says, I'll give the last $2,000 if the rest of you will stand up and give this. And so he says, well, why didn't he just go ahead and give it all? If he knew how much I was having pressure financially, he wouldn't be trying to put pressure on me to give $10 that I don't have. And then The personal frugality by which they live causes their friends and especially their relatives to think they're selfish because they don't give to their wants. Now, if they have needs, the giver would probably help meet their needs, but these relatives and friends want them to give to their wants. And then a lack of response to pressure appeals may make some people in the church think that they're not generous. Though there's something about givers that they make a little money and then they'll give half of it away and they turn around and that half has become a hole and a half. And then they'll give a whole away and keep back the half, and they give it away, and when they turn around, well, that half has become two. And then they'll give one of those away, and they'll turn around, and that one that's left becomes three. And they'll give one and a half away, and they turn around, and that one and a half left becomes five. And that's just the way it goes. A giver has a unique ability to see how this thing can be turned into something worthwhile. And if you had a problem, if you had a problem, a real difficult problem, who would you go to for counsel? To see down through your problem and give you steps to get this thing straight. Who would you go to for that? Exhorter. But if you had a financial problem or if there was something come up and you wanted to know if it was really worthwhile, if it really had the value there, who would you go to? A giver. So it's good to know who the givers are. They're nice people to know. They really know how to manage their money and their affairs to produce money. And then the administrator, he sees the overall picture and he knows how to clarify goals. He's motivated to organize what he's assigned. He desires to complete tasks quickly. We had choir director who's a good administrator. That was his gift. And boy, just as soon as he got it all organized, knew what everybody was to do, and as soon as the cantata was over, well, he is ready to start working on another one. And he liked to complete it quickly, but then he was ready to move on to the next task. In verse 4, he's aware of the resources available to complete a task. And then he knows what he can delegate and what he's going to have to do himself. He has a tendency to stand on the sidelines until it's been turned over to him. And if no one assumes responsibility, well, then he'll take over and lead. He has a willingness to endure reaction from workers. That's why you notice the guide verse says, bless those that curse you, bless and curse not. You know why? Because an administrator, here he is at the top of the pile, and he tells everybody what they're supposed to do. And here's somebody that can't see how what they're doing is fitting into the whole picture. And they say, why do we have to do this? He said, well, look, you may not understand, but you just go ahead and do it. And so they start kicking him on the shin. And they come into his office, and they kick him on the shin. And he gets so much reaction from the workers that he has to learn to bless those who curse him. Bless and curse not. And what that means is when they come into your office, that you bless them in your office, and then when they go out the door, you don't curse them after they're gone. That you bless those that curse you, that you bless, and you curse not. That's really an important quality. This music director we had, boy, people reacted to him like all get out. That poor guy, if people kicked me on the shin once for every time they kicked him on the shin, I wouldn't have been able to live with it. But he could just take it. An administrator has a unique ability to endure reaction and to move on and say, well, okay, but we got to get this job done nonetheless. They have fulfillment in seeing all the pieces come together and the job finished, and then they have a desire to move on to a new challenge when the old one is completed. What are misunderstandings about administrators? Their ability to delegate responsibility sometimes makes them appear lazy. That's why we said a while ago that when you come on the scene, if an administrator is running the job, you see him standing around and four or five people working. If a server is running the job, you see four or five people standing around and the server working. Well, so administrator knows how to get people to work and delegate, but sometimes people say, boy, it looks like he'd get out here and help us if he, you know, really cared about this. And then his willingness to endure reaction may appear as callous. Can you imagine? Now, here's the way an exhorter approaches a situation. We got a Sunday school here, and Mrs. Jones is reacting in the class with Mrs. Smith. Well, an exhorter will move into that situation and say, now, Ms. Jones, Ms. Smith, let's see how we can take some steps to correct this so we can get your attitudes right and create harmony here. And you just stay right here and let's get this straight. Now, Mr. Administrator comes in and says, no, Ms. Jones, we'll just move you over here to this other class, and we'll move Mrs. Brown over here. Why? Because an exhorter is concerned about persons and problems and interaction between people and to get all that straight to create harmony in the body so they can grow. But Mr. Administrator is concerned about the overall picture and the organization, and he wants the organization to be smooth running. So he'll just change this person over here and change that person over there. And because he's that way, Mr. Administrator sometimes will have some pretty gross people in some pretty key positions. Oh, I know, the guy's an alcoholic, and he's teaching that Sunday school class, but you know, he's always on time. See? And he always calls his class. And he always comes up with 100%. I can always count on him, but here this guy that's spiritual, he prayed all night, he may not show up half the time. And so we just fire him and keep this alcoholic over here. And then you go to Mr. Administrator and say, well, now this fellow blew up and his marriage failed and all this kind of stuff. Why didn't you do something about that? What did you do about it? He'd say, well, that wasn't my responsibility. He was carrying out his job. You know, he screwed 27 bolts on nuts on those bolts every day. And as long as he was doing his job and my machinery was running, well, I didn't feel any need to go administer to him personally, you know. Well, that's kind of the way administrators look at things. So they get some reaction sometime because God wants them to learn how to counsel. But they can endure reaction. And, suppose in the church, now here's a lady that's had a Sunday school class for 30 years. and the class has died for 30 years, and she's got about two left. And so a new administrator comes on the scene, and he says, well, we'll take care of that. So he just fires her. And then he puts a new teacher in there. And Miss Mercy Shore out here sees him. What do you think her reaction is going to be to Mr. Administrator? Oh, he was so callous. You know, Ms. Jones taught that class for 30 years, and he just took her out of that, didn't even consider her feelings at all. So you have to watch out. He is considered to be callous, but he's probably following the Lord real well when he did that. Now, the neglect in explaining why tasks must be done may prompt workers to feel that they're just being misused. In other words, an administrator says, do this, and you do this, and you do that. But if he doesn't explain to you how each one of those parts that he's assigned fits in to reach this big goal, then because you can't see the overall picture like he can, you may think, well, man, I'm just over here doing this little old tiddlywinks, and it's not going to amount to anything. So he'll get some reaction on that, and people may feel like they're just being used instead of really being a vital part. And then viewing people as resources may appear that projects are more important than people. And administrators do seem goal-centered, project-oriented, more than people-oriented. Exhorters are people-oriented. Administrators are goal and project-oriented. Let's reach this goal. We're going to get 700 people in Sunday school. You do this, you do that, and we'll reach this goal. We'll get so many people in Bible study. And they're real good trainers. They have an ability to get people trained to do their job. And then five, misunderstanding. Their desire to complete tasks swiftly may appear to be insensitive to the schedule and the weariness of workers. And so people will complain, well, why are you going to make us practice this one more time? Or why do we have to come and get this old training, you know? It's already late and we're ready to go home. So the principle that administrator needs to practice is the principle of authority. In order to be in power and have authority, you have to be under authority. What happens to somebody who doesn't obey his boss when he goes out to tell those four or five people that are working under him to do things? What happens? They react. They don't obey him. So if he doesn't learn to obey what he's told, then he will not be obeyed by those he tells. And so to be in authority and be in power, you have to be under authority and under power. And if you have the gift of administration, one of the biggest problems you're going to have is, and the thing that you're going to need to practice most in your life is harmony with authority. You need to learn to check in and say, now, does this really meet your wishes? Is this really what you want? What's interesting is to see a pastor who has the gift of mercy, and he has a wife who has the gift of administration. Now, under God's scheme of things, here's God, and the Scripture says that the husband is the head of the wife, but here's a wife with the spiritual gift of organizing, and yet she's supposed to be under her husband's authority, and here's a fellow with the gift of mercy, and mercy showers have a tendency to not, thoughts sometimes to be indecisive. It's difficult for them to make decisions because they don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, you know. And so here he is, the pastor of the congregation, and his wife sees all these things that need to be done. So if he's not careful, who's she going to organize? Him. And the people in the church are going to say, well, you know, Brother Tom would be a good pastor if his wife didn't run him, you see. And so it sets a bad example. Now, what should a man do who is in authority over a wife who has the gift of organization? That man needs to assign her, okay, hon, you know, over here, this is your domain. You organize that. And she needs to organize that and not organize him or try to organize the church because she has the gift of organization. She needs to stay under authority in order to be in authority over what she's supposed to organize. So that's free for nothing there. All right, we get to the last gift, the gift of mercy. And the basic characteristics of mercy showers, they have ability to sense the atmosphere of joy or distress in individuals or a group. It's just amazing to me how my wife and mercy showers can sense what's going on in the lives of people, in their spirit, on the inside of them, when she comes on the scene. Maybe she's never been there before. But mercy shores have a unique ability to sense the atmosphere of joy or distress. And notice the guide. A mercy shore is supposed to what? Rejoice with those that rejoice and weep with those that weep. Now the emphasis is upon rejoicing. That's the primary thing, is to rejoice. Because if you don't rejoice with those that rejoice, well, you're not going to get an opportunity to weep with them when they're weeping. So mercy shores, they're a basic characteristic. They attract and understand people that are in distress. And my wife used to wonder, why are all these people calling? Why are all these people coming over to my house? You're the one with the answers. Why aren't they coming to see you? Why are they coming over here to me? And she'd kind of, you know, run from them. But they were sensing her spirit. And a mercy spirit is just the spirit of love. And it just comes out. It's so open and so precious. People just are attracted to that. And especially if the people have been hurt and they're broken, they're bitter, they're wounded. Well, they just really are attracted to people with a mercy spirit. So if you have the spirit of mercy, don't be shocked and surprised when all kinds of weirdos start coming around and taking up with you. One of my friends who has the gift of mercy was in a ministry where he had the gift of mercy, and all these people with all these problems kept coming around. And he thought, well, man, do I need to go get a haircut? Or what is there about me that all these people are coming to me, these people with all these terrible problems? And then when he learned his spiritual gift, well, he learned. He understood. Attraction and understanding of people that are in distress. And then a mercy shore has a desire to remove hurts and to bring healing as quick as possible. If you ask an exhorter, all right, here's a person with a terrific problem. And you ask an exhorter, now what's going to have to happen first? Does this person, are they going to have some steps from Scripture of action so they can gain healing and then start growing for God? Or do they have to have healing and Spirit of God touch them and bring healing to their life, and then they can take some steps and grow? Well, an exhorter would say, well, you got to have the steps first and then the growth can take place. But a mercy shore would say, no, you got to have the healing touch of God first, and then you can hear the steps and take steps to grow. Because a mercy shore sees the healing first, then the steps, and then the growth. And that's just their opposite way of looking at it. A mercy shore has a greater concern for the mental distress than they do for the physical distress. If a mercy shower and a server went over to a lady's house that had just burned down, the server would say, now, don't you worry about a thing, Sally. We got blankets and a place for you to stay, and we're working on this. And they'd whip up on all these physical things. But the mercy shower would sit down by the lady and be entering into her feelings and letting her know, you know, I really care that you've really suffered this great loss. And maybe the mercy shore wouldn't say anything so much as just to be there to feel and to hurt with them. And that people think mercy shores go around bawling all the time. That's not right. The emphasis of a mercy shore is to rejoice with those that rejoice. I've always been amazed at my wife, how she could just rejoice with people, regardless of what kind of blessing they had. Boy, she could just enter in that and be excited and as happy as they were over their blessing. Well, I've always had such a poor self-image, I always thought, well, Lord, why are you blessing him so much and not blessing me? See, that's just how I was. But that wasn't my way. Boy, my wife could really rejoice with them, and then she could really weep with them. One time, one of our young men was out messing around with a telephone wire, and he threw it up at a kite that had gotten caught tangled up in this big highline thing. And the wind caught that wire, and it had a little insulation on it, but it was a copper wire. And there he was standing on the ground, and the wind caught that little piece of wire and threw it over this 7,000 volt highline pole. And all that electricity came down that little wire and right through him and knocked holes in his boots, brought worms from 6 feet up to the surface, threw him on the ground, his elbows dug into the dirt. And, you know, his wife called Marie, and the server took my wife, and they went out there and got him in the hospital. I got him in the car and got him to the hospital, and this wife was just hysterical. Now, my wife's a mercy shore, and they got to the hospital, and usually when something like that happens to you, it'll break every bone in your body, or just, you know, you'll just fall apart as a result. But that guy, he spent the night in the hospital. You know, God just miraculously shielded him, and that guy is some story. But his wife said to my wife, Marie, if when you came out there with Ed and we got in the car and rode to the hospital, if you'd been crying and excited and upset, you wouldn't have helped me at all. But the fact that you were there and you weren't crying and you didn't say anything, but you were there, it just brought the comfort and I was able to just be strengthened by your presence. Well, that's a unique something that a mercy shower has, is that ability to enter into whatever the situation, that emotional distress, and to feel with those people. Servers, physical distress. Relieve that physical need quickly. But mercy showers, the mental distress, the emotional feeling down inside. And then the fifth characteristic, the avoidance of firmness unless he sees how it will bring benefit. Now, a mercy shower can cut you if he's convinced that it will get rid of your problem. But if he's not convinced that this painful cut he's about to give you is going to heal you, well, he'll just stand there and look at you and feel with you, but he won't cut you. Now, we exhorters are delighted to put the knife on you. We don't mind taking a cut, because we're sure if we cut you that you're going to take steps and grow, and we've got it all figured out. But mercy showers are very hesitant to cut people, because they're not sure that it'll do the job. And if they are sure, then they will. And then they have a sensitivity to words and actions that will hurt other people. Mercy showers, when they come into the church and they see a man stand up and he says things, or a lady stand up and she says things that just hurt people, those words are so inconsiderate and insensitive, those mercy spirits servers in the mercy spirits in the church just cringe. That just hurts them, because they sense the hurt this is doing to other people. And then they have an ability to discern sincere motives in other people. Now, they are a pushover for bad character. If this character is a con man, but he's really been hurt, a mercy shower can sense that hurt, and the entering into their hurt, it's amazing how they can do that and just be swept off their feet by poor character. There was one guy who had been in the penitentiary, and I don't know what all he had done. He's one of the grossest guys you ever saw, but he's just precious. You know, his surface countenance and his little meek attitude and the fact that he'd really been hurt and kicked around all his life. Well, my wife thought he was the dearest thing on earth. You know, I mean, she knew he was messed up, but he could come over and she'd cook for him, and man, she just loved him. Just loved him. And I dealt with him, and he was really a skunk, you know. But even though mercy showers can pick up on the spirit of a person, how they've been hurt, sometimes they miss their character if they're really bad characters. And then they have an enjoyment and union with others that are sensitive to the needs and feelings of others. That's why mercy showers really love and have an affinity for servers, because they love the way servers meet the needs of people. And usually mercy showers are attracted to exhorters that enter into people's problems and help bring them healing. And then mercy showers have a tendency to close their spirit to those that are insincere or insensitive. And this is something a mercy shower needs to learn to do, is to keep his or her spirit open to people so they'll know how to pray for them. But when someone comes around, they're loud and they're brash and they're insensitive, a mercy shower will have a tendency just to kind of clam up and close his spirit to that person, to that kind of person. All right, here are the misunderstandings. They avoid firmness, therefore they appear to be weak and indecisive. Their sensitivity to spirits and feelings of others may cause some to feel that they're guided by their emotions rather than logic. And their attraction and understanding of those in distress may be misinterpreted by those of the opposite sex. And that brings us to the thing a mercy shower needs most to apply in his or her life, and that's the principle of freedom or of moral purity. A girl who has a mercy spirit needs to be very, very cautious about her relationship with fellows. And I'll tell you why. Because a mercy spirit, this goes out with such deep and sincere love. You know, it's just such a deep caring that a mercy spirit has. If a girl sends that out to this fellow because she just really cares, then this fellow thinks, oh, she means more by that than just Christian concern. You know, there's something more to this. So she has to be very, very cautious about that mercy spirit going out to fellows and help him to understand. Now, you know, Jesus loves you, and I care about you, and she needs to stay under the protection of her authority, her father, or somebody. A man who has a gift of mercy, especially if he is a counselor, or he's thrown into a situation of caring, and women come to him for counsel, needs to be very careful to walk in moral purity and moral freedom, because when he sends this love spirit out from Christ to these women think, oh, if my husband, if he just were that caring, if he just loved me like this wonderful Christian counselor does. And so she will take his deep, genuine concern to mean something that he really didn't mean at all. And that's how people get in trouble morally sometimes, is because they misinterpret the spirit of the person that's caring, and then they get involved physically and mess up. All right, the sensitivity to words and actions which cause hurts may appear to be taking up another's offense. The thing a mercy shower needs to really watch out for is not to get mad at Susie because she hurt Jane, who is mercy shower's friend. If Jane is your friend and somebody in the church hurt her, that's between God and her and the one that hurt her. It's none of your business. And Psalm 15 says, do not take up another's offense. Do not take up another's approach. Probably one of the greatest revivals that would ever happen in history would be if all the people in the church that are mad at somebody because they hurt somebody else that's their friend. I'm mad at the pastor because he hurt Aunt Nellie, and she's such a godly woman, and he didn't have any business saying what he did. You know, that was between the pastor, God, and Aunt Nellie. But mercy shower hears what the pastor said, or hears about what the pastor said, which is a violation of Scripture, and then she takes up an offense. Some of you, I imagine, here in this room, have taken up an offense against your daddy because your daddy hurt your mother. That was between your daddy, your mother, and God. It was none of your business. Some of you are mad at your mother, and you've taken up an offense against her for your daddy. You don't think she's doing your daddy right. That's between her, your daddy, and God. And the thing about it, when the mercy shower or anybody takes up an offense in the church, all right, here's Sally's hurt. Sally's my friend. Joe hurt her. I'm mad at Joe because he hurt Sally. And then Sally, she doesn't seem to be hurt. And Sally forgives Joe, and they're buddy-buddy, and now I'm mad at Sally. Why aren't you still mad at Joe after what he did? Do you know why I'm still that way? My dad used to hurt my mother so bad. My mother didn't seem to hurt her so bad. But it hurt me so bad. You know why it hurt me so bad and didn't hurt mother so bad? Because God only gives grace to the one that's hurt. If you get hurt, God gives you grace, which is the desire and power to respond to that hurt like Jesus would. But if it wasn't any of your business, God's not going to give you any grace. And if you take up an offense, since you didn't get any grace, you're not going to be able to respond, and you're going to be mad and bitter and messed up. So if you've been taking up somebody else's offense, that's a negative of a mercy shower, but it's not the exclusive property of a mercy shower. I've known prophets and others of us that have done that sin too. So we need to forgive everybody that's hurt anybody that has hurt us, or they've hurt anybody else that we love, that we think they were wrong. And then a mercy shower needs to really watch out for that. And then the last one, they have an ability, or the ability to detect insincere motives may cause some to feel that they're hard to get to know. Now, what that means is, when this loud, brash, insensitive person comes on the scene, what does Miss Mercy Shower or Mr. Mercy Shower do? Close their spirit. And so this loud, brash, insensitive person comes around and gets up next to Mr. Mercy Shower or Miss Mercy Shower, and they say, boy, she sure is hard to get to know. Why? Because they can sense that your spirit is closed to them. And so they think that you're kind of stuck up or something. So all mercy showers and all of us need to learn to keep our spirit open, because if we're not rejoicing with them when they're rejoicing and when they're frolicking and when they're hurting people and brash, we're not going to have the privilege to suffer with them when they're suffering and give them steps to get their life straight. All right? So the principle a mercy shower needs most to practice is the principle of moral purity. Now, I'm an exhorter. My wife is a mercy shower. Why did God allow her as a mercy shower to be married to an exhorter? Well, he was concerned looking after me mainly. But God gave me a mercy shower so that I would learn from her how to enter into people's hurts and feel with them before I start giving them these painful steps to get their life straight. God gave her to me for that reason. But God didn't want her as a mercy shower just to feel with people. God wanted her to be able to enter into their feelings, and then when she sensed their hurts, to be able to take steps to be able to be willing to give them steps of action to get their life straight. Now, some Mercy Shores will just stand there and hurt with you all day long, but they'll never tell you anything to get out of your mess. They'll just let you, every moment you'll be sinking down farther into your quicksand because they just feel with you and hurt with you. Well, that's the way Marie always was. But now, after living with an exhorter for 20 years, she's learning how to give people steps of action to get out of their quicksand. And that's what God wants her to do. Pat?
Yeah. When you were saying, in terms of taking up an offense, you said it was none of my business. It was God, Aunt Sally's, and Aunt Jane's, or whatever. You mean that in terms of taking up the offense, not in helping them get back together?
Right. Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers. It is your business on that basis. Or if you see Sally hurt Joe, it is your responsibility, since you saw it, to let Sally know, Sally, I'd really like to be able to give a good report of you, but after I saw what you did to Joe, I wonder, maybe I misunderstood this. Would you mind sharing this with me? And then you'd take an opportunity to help Sally not to treat Joe that way. It is your business as a Christian brother to help one you see fall into sin. It is not your business to take up a reproach when you see someone hurt in the body of Christ. And I didn't make that clear. Thank you for that. Okay. What music does a Mercy Shower like? Sweet, sweet spirit in this place. Yeah, that's right. Okay, they love the emphasis on worship and all that. Okay, suppose a preacher suppose he preaches sin, righteousness, and judgment. Would that necessarily mean that he was a prophet? No. How would he know whether he was a prophet or something else? If you said, why did you preach so hard? Why did you preach sin, righteousness, and judgment like you did? Well, he said, because, boy, I want people to get right with God so they'll quit hurting one another. What do you think his gift is? Mercy. See? And so just because they may act like on the surface somebody else, and the Mercy Showers, because they tend to close their spirit when these hard, brass people come around. And Mercy Shores, boy, I've got a little boy at our house that's a Mercy Shore, and these are special people. But there's something about a guy that's a Mercy Shore in our society, it's really especially tough for them. Because a guy is supposed to be tough, you know? And if he shows any kind of weakness, or if he cries, or shows a sympathy, well, he's kind of, you know. And so can you imagine the pain that a mercy-showing fella has to go through in our society because of that emphasis? And I've discovered that mercy-showers develop a hard exterior sometimes. And sometimes that's why mercy-showers think they're prophets at first. And it's not because they're prophets, it's just because they're brash, or they're not, or they're kind of bitter, crusted over mercy-showers. And the way they got that way was, instead of letting their true spirit of mercy go out when they saw people hurt and they got in hurtful situations, they braced themselves. And they refused to really let their spirit go out and feel and cry if they needed to, or enter in pain and to show the love spirit. So this guy that I was talking about that got that electricity, he's a mercy shower, and he joined the Marines when he was a kid. He played football, and he joined the Marines when he was really a kid. And they came through one day and said, how many of you would like to learn judo and karate? And so he and some other fellows raised their hand. And so he went through I don't know how many belts. And finally, when he got a black belt, well, they came in one day, and they had all these black belts to stand up. And there he stood up. And this guy said, congratulations, you've just made the SEALs. Now, the SEALs is the Marine equivalent to the Green Beret, only they're more skilled and trained in all the sabotage and killing and all that kind of stuff than even the Green Berets. So here he was, and he'd gotten into that, and that wasn't what he wanted to do. So here he was, a Marine SEAL. And they put him in prison at this camp, and they gave him a code. And they said, all right, you memorize this code, and it was on a piece of paper, and then he put it in his mouth, and you swallowed it. And then they beat him and torture him and do all kinds of stuff to try to get that message out of him. And he told me what all suffering he went through, and I said, Jack, man, why didn't you ever tell him? Boy, I believe I'd have told him that number. He said, I couldn't remember. But I don't know how many trips he made back and forth to Vietnam, you know. And then when he got saved and he came to our fellowship and we studied spiritual gifts and it looked like he was going to be a mercy shower, he'd say, man, I'm no mercy shower. I can take a chicken by the neck till it squeeze it till its eyeball pop out. But guess what his spiritual gift is? He's a mercy shower. And all his life he's been fighting and, you know, being a black belt and all this stuff, try to prove people he's tough to overcome that. But he really does have the gift of mercy. And he attracts people. Man, he attracts people. It's really beautiful. All right, are there any questions? Okay, let me ask you. Let me back to your first original sheet. You know that little test you took? How many of you marked number one? Would you raise your hand? All right, now, the number one is a prophet. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you are a prophet. It could be that you were raised in a church, that's the way that church grew up. It was built around the preaching of sin, righteousness, and judgment. And so, because you were raised on that, you think, well, that's the way it's supposed to be. So, you may have checked it for that reason. Or you may be a prophet, if that's really the way you look at it. You know, one time in our house, one of the reasons it helped convince me that my son Harold's a prophet is because there was a deal came up and, you know, I thought I was just trying to be honest and fair with everybody concerned in a little old situation. And my son said, well, Dad, that's just a lie. Now, who is it that comes on like that? Well, prophets, they see it's all white or it's all black. There's nothing in between. And so that kind of helps you to discern who the people are around your family and helps you to understand why they do that way so you don't have to react so strong, you know, when they react strong to you. Okay. How many of you mark number two? All right. Number two is the server. That's generally the way a server would approach building a church. And that doesn't necessarily mean you're a server, but it could be. It's a good pointer to what your gift may be. When my wife marked this test first time, she checked the last one, and I laughed. But it was really true. It was really accurate. The last one is the gift of mercy. And because many times she didn't show mercy on me, I thought, well, man, surely this woman's not a mercy shower. And my wife liked harmony so much, then later she checked organizer, the sixth one down there, organizer, because she liked smooth-running organization. And a mercy shower lacks harmony and the emphasis on harmony and unity in a smooth-running organization. So if you have the gift of mercy, you might have a close affinity for that sixth one on there, the organizer. How many of you mark number three? That's the teacher. Emphasis on word study. You like to study and dig in and read. You're just really well at home with books. And you'd a lot rather read the books and study and clarify than to share it and speak. All right, how many of you mark number four? Look at all these exhorters, would you? All right, that's the exhortation motivation. How many of you mark number five? That's the giver. Any givers in this bunch? Come on, givers. We were praying for some givers here. I don't know where these people are. There are not very many of them that I ever... There are always just a few in any group that I've ever seen. But there are a few. But maybe a part of it is that they don't want anybody to know who they are. But they have a unique ability to know what's worthwhile and to make money, to increase their wealth, to give more. But the thing that gives them their greatest joy is just giving. Giving to meet people's needs. Giving to ministries. Giving the highest quality. And then, how many of you mark number six, the organizer? Do we have any organizers? Anybody? One? Okay. All right. How many of you mark the last one? How many mercy showers? Okay, I believe that's the biggest number. I believe that's more mercy showers than anybody else. Okay, are there any questions about these different... Would anybody not... How many of you think that what you've marked, now that you've gone, you've heard all this, you think that probably the one you marked's really not true, that maybe you're something else? How many of you think that's true? Okay, you marked something that... All right. All right, let's just see. How many of you think you're prophets? Let's see. All right, three. That's going to be a small group. How many of you think you are a server? Okay, how many of you teachers? How many of you exhorters? Oh boy, y'all, a bunch of you marked it that don't think you are now. How many of you are givers? Anybody that's a giver? Still no givers. How many of you organizers? Okay, we had one to mark it and one to admit it. Okay, how many of you are mercy showers? You know you're a mercy shower. Okay, how many of you are not sure what you are? Okay, so we have several that are not sure. Why don't I meet with the not sures and the people where like there was just one. But before we break up into groups, are there any special questions now about your gift that you have? Mark?
Now, what about teaching? You were saying that you like to study and like books. Does that also mean, like, what the word means as far as being able to, would you like to share it too? Or does it just mean liking to do it?
All right. This is the old problem of getting a ministry confused with a motivation. Now, I love to study. I really love to study. I love to look up words and see what they mean and to read and to study. My wife just can't understand how I can go. I could go to my study at 5 o'clock in the morning. I used to have a little cubby hole up over the baptistry at the church where I came from. And I could go over there at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. And at 5 and 6 o'clock in the evening or 10 o'clock at night, I could still be in there and just reveling in it. Just being alone with God and studying, digging in, clarifying things. And I love that. But that was a ministry for me. That wasn't motivation. Though I enjoyed the study and clarifying things and writing and learning and all that kind of stuff, the thing that gave me the greatest joy was getting out of that study and going and telling people step one, two, three for their life. And if I had a choice between going to study or go talk to somebody, I'd go talk to somebody. But I had to go study to get ready to have something for them when I got there. So now teacher, though, a teacher would just love to study, and it wouldn't bother them if they didn't come out to talk to somebody. Though they may enjoy talking to somebody, but if they had their rathers, and the thing that gave them the greatest joy, it would be the study. It wouldn't be the sharing with somebody. Now, prophets and teachers have a close affinity for each other. Prophets love teachers because teachers have an ability to dig into the Word and dig out the truth and say, boy, this is what that means. And Billy Graham's kind says, man, that's great. Thank you for digging that out. And then they take it and say, with a word. And they say, the Bible says. And of course, teachers really love those prophets because the teacher digs all that stuff out. But when they stand up and they share it, well, boy, people don't get on the edge of their seats all that excited usually over a sharing of a teacher. And so they really admire prophets. Teachers and prophets have a great affinity for each other.